Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available at carthage.edu. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's previously scheduled interview with Nan Calvert, Sister Janet and Jane Herring talking about EcoFest has had to be postponed. We look forward to having all three of those guests joining us on next Thursday's morning show. In its place, one of my favorite sports-related morning shows from the archives. It's always fun when we can delve into the complex and exciting world of sports on WGTD's morning show, and especially when we can do so with someone as intelligent and articulate and richly experienced as Bob Ryan, one of the country's best known and most admired sports writers and columnists. He did exemplary work for the Boston Globe until 2012, was there for 45 years, and has written a number of different important books. In his biography is mentioned something that not everybody gets to say. He has been elected to four different halls of fame, the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, the USBWA Hall of Fame for College Basketball Writers, the National Sportscasters and Sports Writers Association Hall of Fame, and the New England Basketball Hall of Fame. So we're talking to someone highly admired today and still seen on a regular basis on various programs on ESPN. He has written a very interesting and entertaining memoir about his long career as a sports writer, a book which is called Scribe, My Life in Sports, published by Bloomsbury. It comes on the heels of a number of terrific books that he has written, including the Larry Bird autobiography Drive, The Story of My Life, as well as When Boston Won the World Series, The Boston Celtics, The History, Legend, and Images of America's Most Celebrated Team, and many other fine books as well. Again, today we're talking about Scribe, My Life in Sports. And Bob Ryan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Very nice complimentary opening.
And I very much have enjoyed reading through your book, which certainly gives us nothing but the highlights, a few highlights of a rich and interesting life which you have led. The second chapter of the book actually begins with some words about your very first effort as a sports writer for something called The Sportster. Tell our listeners about The Sportster.
I was 11, and I decided I was ready to try to write something on my own, having been highly interested in sports reading some time. I was about five, and I wrote a column. It was called The Sportster, and it basically was observations about the basketball league in which I played. I was the local Mercer County parochial basketball league in Trenton, New Jersey. I went to St. Joseph's School, and I was on the team, and threw in a few national sprinkling observations, including one on the Celtics. And that was the first time I ever wrote anything. I had that thing for years and years and years, and somehow in the midst of the moves that everyone inevitably makes, it got lost. It's a shame.
Aww.
I did do that, and it was that's my first attempt at writing. Was when I was 11.
When you talk about your experience as a boy who absolutely loved sports, you make an observation that I found really fascinating that I would like you to talk about a little more. You wrote, "I don't think there is a remote doubt that I was destined to do this. Sports writing is a two-part word, and my entire life has been devoted to both aspects. Anytime I was taken by my father to a local sporting event, say, for example, a Friday night Trenton Catholic High School basketball game, I did not consider the experience to have had any validity until I read about it the following day in the morning Trentonian, a tabloid published in my hometown of Trenton, New Jersey. Part of it was making sure I saw what I thought I saw. The other part was the writing. Words mattered to me. I just find that fascinating, though, the idea that even as a young boy, the experience of going to a, you know, let's say a big-time basketball game and experiencing all that excitement would have been, even for you at a young age, incomplete without that experience of reading about it the next day. I don't know how many people would say that exactly the way you say it.
There aren't many, and that simply is a product of the wiring, the DNA, the aptitude that was implanted in me, the genetics. It is unusual, and I was unusual in that regard, and I was a kid who loved reading as every bit as much as I loved playing. And believe me, I lived a totally normal 1950s existence in terms of what I did with my daily life, going to school and then playing after school and playing all summer. I lived a totally normal life, with the exception that I embellished it or added to it by reading. That mattered to me. I can't explain it. That's who I am. And that is why I truly believe that if ever anybody that was growing up in was kind of programmed to become a sports writer, it was me.
And I found it really interesting at one point when you talk about entering adolescence, you write that I became increasingly aware of my own athletic mortality.
Yeah.
Which I think in part fueled your interest in really focusing your energies on writing. Tell us a little more about what you're saying there, about that process of becoming aware of your own athletic mortality.
Sure. I was a little league, pretty good. I was an all-star in the league. When I was 11, I was on the all-star team. When I was 12, I was an all-star. I was a good first baseman. I could not make the transfer to the 90-foot diamond for two reasons. I had a bad arm, and I was very, very slow. And the 90-foot diamond was too much for me. I was never that was the effective end of a viable baseball career. The one sport I could still play, despite the speed problem, because the arm doesn't matter, is basketball. And I was able to play basketball, and I relished playing basketball. I wish I could still play basketball. I miss playing 3-on-3. And that mattered to me. It was crucial that I could still play basketball for me. And I played throughout the prep school level and started and played, and that was extremely important to me. So, but I knew that there was a limit to my athletic career pretty early on. I mean, I wasn't dreaming about playing in the NBA. I just wanted to have a good scholastic career and then see what would happen after that. And what happened after that was that I went out for a freshman team at Boston College in 1964, and it just so happened that it took the bad time to do so. Bob Cousy was the coach. He had six scholarship players, and two others would turn down other D1 scholarships to play for him, which meant there were four spots available and about 100 kids trying out. And I got through the first cut. That was the one. That was the peak of my career. And then from that point on, I'm an intramural player for 4 years and pick up player basketball for another 25 years. So, but I knew there was I was never going to be a pro. But I concentrated on every other aspect of it, which included writing. I was a triple threat, unlike many people in prep school or high school, because you don't find many managers. I was the manager of the football team. You don't find many managers. That's usually the doofus, you know, nerd guy with the pocket protector and the image of it. But who played a sport. But I was a starter on the basketball team. I was a manager of the football team, and I was the sports editor of the school paper. So in that sense, I was a triple threat. And it's a background that, quite frankly, not everybody has.
Right. You also mention in the third chapter of the book called Trenton Born that you really appreciate the fact that you grew up in Trenton, New Jersey, although you say, I'm from Trenton, New Jersey, which I'm often kidded is a good place to be from, not in. But you go on to say that you really feel lucky that Trenton was and remains your hometown. And you think a lot of what you experienced in Trenton, really shaped who you became and helped equip you for the success that you've enjoyed. What was it about Trenton?
Okay, number one, geography. Trenton is 40 miles from Philadelphia and 60 from New York. So you're permeated with sports atmosphere and professional interest and coverage from both of those cities. And number two, Trenton itself was a highly active and successful and vibrant sports town in high school and also American Legion baseball throughout the 60s. Trenton Catholic was a perennial state power. Trenton High was very good. They peaked in 1961. They won the Group 4 state championship with an undefeated team. There was always something big going on in the high school world in basketball, particularly in Trenton, and also in baseball. And the Legion was a major factor in the summer. We followed the Trenton post-93 Schrotes. That's S-C-H-R-O-T-H-S. I don't know what the hell it meant, but they were the Schrotes. They had won a national championship in 1948, by the way, when I was two, and it was still very, very important. Everything, sports were really, really big in Trenton, and we had two newspapers. Now, here we go. The Trenton Times and the Trentonian, which are still in existence. By far the smallest market in America that has competing daily newspapers is Trenton, New Jersey, and that still exists, and that competition still exists. Why, I don't know. Why Trenton alone has that size can support two papers, I don't know, but they do. So you had lots to read, in addition to which, the key, television. Think about this. In the 50s, 99% of America markets had the three network channels and nothing else. You had three channels, and you had limited options. Trenton, New Jersey, located as it was, got everything on the dial with the exception of Channel 8. We got everything from 2 to 13 because we got everything in Philadelphia and we got everything in New York. And, of course, in New York, in addition to the three networks, you had Channel 5, 9, and 11 that were offering individual programming. And it just so happened that in going up, the Giants and Yankees games were on Channel 11, the Dodgers games were on Channel 9, and the Phillies games were on Channel 6. So while much of America was restricted to a game of the week. We got games in multiple form week after week, year after year, until the Giants and Dodgers left to go to the coast, and we still had the Yankees and the Phillies. And so this ability to see Major League Baseball and to become knowledgeable, on top of which, so that made Trenton, and then throw in radio. Because when rock and roll hit, and we can argue what the first rock and roll song or whatever, but we can certainly say that by 1955, rock and roll was entrenched, and Elvis was here, and rock and roll was taking over the top 40. We had opportunity to have the stations in both New York and Philadelphia when those stations, the top 40 stations, were predominant. And so you had a better chance to sample rock and roll, and then music meant a great deal to me. And as a final kicker, Trenton, New Jersey, it has great proximity to the Jersey Shore, and I need say no more for anybody who knows the East and knows how important to us the Jersey Shore was. It's a great place to live.
Mm. I'm speaking with Bob Ryan and talking with him about his new memoir, just published by Bloomsbury, called Scribe, My Life in Sports. Once we move past high school and your experience at Boston College, you become a reporter. And you are covering the NBA and specifically the Boston Celtics. And I would love to have you expand on a observation that you made about getting to the end of that very first year when you wrote, I realized later all kinds of things must have gone on with the Celtics that went unreported, including various frictions. That probably would have made some very good stories, but that's what happens when you don't travel. I have long maintained that if I were given a choice between covering all the home games or all the road games, I would take the road games, because that's when you learn what a team is really like, on and off the court or field. Tell us more.
It's so self-evident that the road reveals athletic character, and you see per human behavior, and it's very valuable. And my first year, the Boston Globe did not send me on the road. Nobody in Boston had ever traveled regularly on the road during the entire existence of the Boston Celtics, which included the 11 championship seasons between 1956 and 69. Boston basketball wasn't very important. It was a niche sport. During the playoffs, people traveled, but during the regular season, they didn't. And I didn't get on the road on a semi-regular basis until my second year, 70-71. And from that point on, I would always get on the road after the end of the high school football season. I covered high school football for 5 years while I was concurrently covering the Celtics. And I got on the road full-time with the going to the West Coast and so forth, not until my fourth season, 72-73. We were able to convince them that it was worth sending somebody to the West Coast. So, that's the background. It's just so self-evident. I think you explained it. You'd learn more about people and a team. You see a team in crisis on the road. You find out how good a team really is. You cannot evaluate a team until you see it on the road. And you see how people react to the road circumstance. And then, of course, the personal behavior factor. And you get to know people. You have more downtime. You might wind up having breakfast accidentally, or lunch intentionally, or dinner intentionally, which I did on any number of occasions. I went out drinking with them after every game for many years, and at a point when that's what guys did. They don't do that so much anymore, but they did that then, and I was part of the group. Nobody thought it was odd. That circumstance has disappeared completely, and that's one reason why I'm glad, as I say many times in this book, I'm glad I did what I did when I did it.
You mentioned that for quite a long period of time, you were the only person covering daily Celtics practices. And that sort of seems incredible to read those words, and yet there it is. Is it more common for that, for such things to be covered now?
Well, now the practices are attended by the newspapers, plural, by radio stations, local radio stations, local television stations, websites, including their own, etc. So it got to the point by the end of the Bird era that it was getting too many people around that you couldn't allow the access to the locker room, because you couldn't even control who was in there as much, and would know what kind of, how they knew how to handle themselves. One of the things that you learn early on, you're a salesman in this job. I'm going to back up. You're a salesperson. You're selling yourself to the team, players, to the coach, staff, and to the management, that you are a person of credibility and are trustworthy. What does the trust mean? It means that you know the difference between what's reportable and what's not reportable. You know what's reportable, what's not necessarily reportable now, but might be reportable in three weeks or 6 months as the dust settles, and you can protect people from the quotes or the information that you're being given. But you can still use it in a way that, as you learn to use it. This takes time to develop the trust. Well, when you're the only person and you're in there every day and you're at practice an hour before the game, and you're just talking to these guys casually, no notebook, and you know all their kids' names and their wives' names, and you get to know them very well, and you get to know the coach very well, and suddenly as time goes on, not suddenly, gradually as time goes on, and the thing got bigger and more important, more and more people were around, and to the point where they had to restrict the access, because say you can't go in the locker room at all, because you don't know what idiots in there overhearing your conversation that I never would have reported for obvious reasons, and they might report it. And that's the reason why locker rooms are closed. There's so many people at every practice that they can't govern it. But when it was only me, they had no problem. So I had this access. My competitor at the Herald, Ed Yohuli, was overburdened. He had three jobs. He was covering the Celtics. He was a college football prognosticator, and he worked the desk. He didn't have time to go to practice, and I did, and it was an incredible asset.
You end up covering the Celtics, I think, in sort of three periods, that is, with some breaks in between. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about why you stepped away from this beat the first time around, it was for a couple of different reasons, including a somewhat antagonistic relationship with the coach at the time, but also you admit to us, as you admitted to yourself, that, in your words, I had really gotten too close to the players. I cared too much. Tell us a little more about that and where that fine line is, because obviously a good reporter wants to get somewhat close to the players he's covering, and yet at some point, evidently, you became closer than was advantageous for the work you were there
to
do.
And there was a third reason as well. The first reason was the Heinsohn thing. It was the growing friction. He objected to my relationship with the players, thought that when I was reflecting things in print that reflected their viewpoint or that I was agreeing with, say, rather than his, he took issue and didn't take it very well at all, and this led to twice, at least two or three occasions, told them that not to talk to me, and on each occasion I would have what I would refer to as the minutes of the meeting delivered to me within 30 minutes on the clock, because they all thought it was preposterous, and they knew it was stupid, and they had no intention of not talking to me, and that was fine. That was great, but that made them even angrier. And so by the time we got to the finals in 76, things were going on, and I knew that if I had stayed around another year at that point, we would have had continual conflict. It wouldn't have been bad for me, bad for the readers. And so I knew that it was time to step away. And this, another reason was there's only so many kind of games, really, 10 or 12 different kind of NBA games patterns. And after a while, you've written a lot of games, and you're finding yourself repeating yourself, and you need to step away and recharge the batteries, if you will, and let new people come in. And then maybe, if you ever come back, it's a different set of circumstances. But the other thing was, I think it was wearing. I did care a lot. I did have great close relationships with people, and it just was wearing me out a little bit. I mean, I really remember coming home. But I came home from the playoffs in 75, and I said to my wife, I never used this verb before and in this context. I need a vacation.
Hmm.
And I was 29 years old. I needed a vacation, and we went away, and I, on the spot, booked the trip because I needed to get away and settle down. And that's because I did care so much. And that was a youthful enthusiasm, and I got things were growing, and that people cared, and the beat took off in a way I never would have imagined. And no one had in the relationship or circumstance in Boston of covering basketball where things were as intense as they were when I was doing it in those years. And you're right, I did it three times. I did it from 79 to 69 to 76. I came back in 78, 4 years. That's when I left to go to television for a year and a half, came back, and then we picked up the team for the third and final time in the middle of the 85-86 season. And the only reason I got off the beat that time was I was taken off the beat because at the end of 87-88, because I had a book coming out with Larry Bird, and they wanted to go through that, didn't want to have that appearance of conflict of interest, that, blah, blah, blah. That's fine. So I got off the beat, and a year later I became a columnist, and that's what I did for the final 5 years of my career was write columns.
Hmm. We should mention that in addition to covering the Boston Celtics, you also had the really exciting opportunity to cover the so-called Dream Team, that amazing group of basketball pros who actually competed in the Olympics along with other international competitions. And you really offer us a refreshing perspective on that, including a perspective that helps some people maybe better understand how other countries could actually enjoy the experience of being absolutely clubbed to death by such an overpowering force like that first so-called Dream Team. Tell our listeners about that, about the perspective you have on that the Dream Team and those mismatches that were actually a kind of a joyous experience for everyone involved.
Americans then, and maybe even some now, did not ever understand. They didn't get it. They were operating under the mistaken notion that we wanted this, that we were doing this, putting it together an NBA team and storming into the Olympics because we were stung and upset after having lost the gold medal to the Soviet Union in 1988, and that had nothing to do with anything. The Dream Team was the byproduct of the vision of a man named Boris Stankovic, a Serbian who was the president, commission, whatever they called him. He had an exalted chairman title of the executive director, whatever, of FIBA, the World International Governing Basketball Body. And the NBA had, in the David Stern era, began to have more of a relationship with FIBA, as David recognized the potential of for the NBA of global growth and what it would mean. So the United States of America voted against the American participation, the professional participation in the FIBA meeting, but they were voted down. And so, okay, all right, you got it. You want us? We're coming. Okay. Why did he want this? Very simple. He thought the only way he wanted to raise the bar as high as it could to show the rest of the world where they have to go in basketball. It's just that simple. He's a basketball lover, and he knew that the only way the world was ever going to eventually someday have a better basketball was to find out what it's all about and at the highest level, hence the Dream Team. And I'll just sum up the experience. It started with the Cuban team in the first game at the Tournament of the American qualifying tournament in Portland, Oregon, asking to have their picture taken with the USA team prior to the game, which went on for the duration of the summer. I was highlighted by an incident in a game against Argentina in which a guard named Marco Milanesio, who was 6 feet five and a good player, and I probably would say would be a candidate for player of the year in a mid-major league, such as the MAC or a league like that, maybe the Missouri Valley Conference, he found himself with Magic Johnson having picked him up on a switch, and he was posting up at the time on the box. And here he's got Magic Johnson behind him, and he's posting up Magic Johnson. He's right in front of his own bench. He is yelling over to his bench, "Fotografia, fotografia." He wanted his picture taken for posterity, for his children and grandchildren, that he was posting up Magic Johnson. And it is for that reason that I came up with the way to describe what the entire experience was all about for the rest of the world, who knew they were not going to win. It was beat me, whip me, take my picture. And it was an honor in their minds to be dunked on by the Americans. They wanted to say they played against the Americans. Now, we know what happened. America trailed once in all the games with one possession against Croatia in the gold medal game, and Charles Barkley came down, hit a three 15 seconds later, and we took the lead back and went on to win by 32 points. 2 years later, in the first time that we renewed competition with the rest of the world in Toronto at the World Championships, in the third quarter, score was 59-54, we're playing Russia, and can't shake them. Things aren't going well. And Don Nelson was the coach. Chuck Daly had famously never called a timeout. And every substitution he made was to give somebody a blow or just to get everybody in the game. And he called timeout, and he made a substitution. And the substitution was Shaquille for Alonzo Mourning. And the reason? He needed to get better on the floor. It was a substitution for need. And I believe this is a historic moment in the history of international basketball, the first time that American coach had to make a substitution for need. Well, during that tournament, we trailed a lot. We struggled a lot. No, we wound up winning. And it set the forces in motion so that by 1996, we were the champions of nothing. We didn't have the gold medal, and we didn't have the world championship. And that's when Jerry Colangelo came in, hired Mike Krzyzewski. We revamped the whole circumstance. We got people fired up. And here we are now. We're back on top again. Disturbingly, romping through this latest world championship, something is stagnant with the rest of the world now. I've heard varying opinions about what that might be, but I'm very upset and disappointed that the rest of the world has receded now after having stood up to the fiery dragon. But trust me, the reason that they're even anywhere near as good as they are now is the dream team. A kid like Dirk Nowitzki was a young kid in Würzburg, Germany, looking at this saying, "I want to be a basketball player." Manu Ginobili was a young Argentine in Bahia Blanca, Argentina, looking at the Dream Team saying, "I want to be a basketball player." That's the legacy of the Dream Team.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Bob Ryan, author of Scribe, My Life in Sports. Mr. Ryan, can I ask you a couple more questions?
Surely.
You speak with great exuberance about another sport, namely baseball. You open Chapter 8 of your book by saying, "This may seem strange coming from someone best known for his basketball background, but baseball is the greatest game ever to spring from the mind of mortal man. I believe that with all my heart." So back those exuberant words up. What is it about baseball that you think makes it such an extraordinarily wonderful game?
Ultimate thinking man's game, the endless possibilities, the dissection possible at every at-bat, every pitching choice, every positioning of the fielder, the innumerable circumstances, the wonderful quirks about baseball. For example, you can do everything right and come out wrong. You can do something pretty much totally wrong and it come out right. What do I mean? Well, someday it's conceivable. It'll probably never happen. Someday some guy will throw a perfect game with 27 line drive outs. It's possible. You can hit the ball 450 feet and be an out. You can hit a dribbler 10 feet up the first baseline and drive in the winning run in the World Series. That's the great nature of baseball. The difference between a 2-2 when the base is loaded and 3-2 with the runners running on 3-2. On and on and on and on and on. There is just no end to the possibilities. I believe there was more to discuss about baseball than the other three sports put together. There's more conversational fodder, be it historical or current. And I love basketball. It's made my career. I love to play basketball. I have strong opinions about basketball. But it's like 50.5 to 49.5, 51-49. Baseball is the best game. And I think Red Smith summed it up decades ago. Said people say baseball. Said baseball is only dull to people with dull minds. And I'll stand on that. I absolutely cannot. You know, you can't say now. Does it have problems? We allowed it to evolve in a way, thanks to Tony La Russa, who's had the most negative effect on baseball on anybody in the last 30 years with his micromanaged pitching ideas, which have been stolen and copied by everybody. Is it too slow? Do you realize the first two Orioles and KC games are both, even a nine-inning game, went 4 hours and 17 minutes? Yes. Is there anything we can do about it? I'm not sure. I don't like that aspect of it. It does drag now, the way they're playing it. There's a problem. I grant you, and it's one that really should be seriously addressed. But it's still the best game for me.
You talk about how covering baseball is kind of a different gauntlet compared to some of the other gigs you've had as a sports writer. At one point, you say immersing yourself in a full baseball season is a test of fidelity. Covering basketball is full-time taxing, but covering baseball from spring training to season's end is a lifestyle.
So
and
is.
That's a very different thing.
Very different. I mean, I covered both. I did the Red Sox only one full season, 1977. The only reason I didn't do more, a guy named Gammons came back to the Globe, and of course, when the big dog comes back, you have to step aside, and I certainly recognize that. I enjoyed my baseball writing that year. I would have enjoyed covering the team longer, but it was long enough that one year to realize the difference. You know, I remember coming home one time. You know, you come home from a road trip and at two, you know, maybe 2-3 in the morning, and you're back at the ballpark the next day at 3. Often, I mean, there's no other sport like that. I remember coming up home at one time from the West Coast at like 5 a.m. and a neighbor of mine who worked in the Boston Flower District and was going to bed. He was going to work and I was coming in. That doesn't happen in basketball. And it's just a day-to-day, that day-to-day grind of baseball. There are a few off days in the other sports. Football, once a week. I could not imagine covering football. It bore me to totally bore me to think that it was only one game a week. But baseball is the flip side of that. And it's a grind. And people who go on and cover it for years and years and years, they have to love it. They have to love it because even as much as I love it, I don't want it 27 days a week for 6 months that without having some other time to catch my breath. No, it is a lifestyle, it's a difficult one.
For somebody who reads your book and is not particularly well-read in baseball, I think they might not fully appreciate a really interesting thing you say about when you go to a baseball game, even when you're just there as a normal civilian, so to speak, versus there as a reporter, you always are keeping score. And I think for some people, when they glance at those words, they think, well, don't we all keep score? But you're talking about keeping score in a very special way, down to a very sort of sophisticated level of detail. Tell us what you do at each and every baseball game that you attend.
Well, I think anyone who's even casually familiar with the game understands about what keeping score in a game means.
Right. I mean, for our listeners who aren't.
They generally associate it only with people who are actually working a game. Okay. I started keeping score full-time and keeping track of – I always kept score at any game I covered officially, but I didn't always keep score at games I was attending when I wasn't working until I began covering the team in 1977. I kept score at every exhibition game I covered, and nobody does that. I was so excited and thrilled to be around, and I meticulously kept score at every exhibition game that year. I never did that again, okay? But I covered the 130 games that year, and of course I kept score. And I starting in 78, when I was now not – anytime I went to the ballpark, I took my book, my Dutch Ball Writers Association scorebook, and I have kept score at every single game I've gone to, privately or publicly, since 1977. I have 8 scorebooks full of games, And I have so many wonderful moments that are any baseball fan, great fan, would love. I wrote a column once about the contents of the scorebook and the odd games and the oddities. I mean, the things that I saw that you haven't recorded. And any baseball, this is why I was talking. This reverts back to what I was saying earlier about there being more conversational fodder in baseball than everything else put together. There is no such comparable thing in football, basketball, or hockey. There is no comparable thing that anybody has. There's no official scorebook that people keep. There's no official, but there is in baseball. I mean, we can talk about so many oddities. I have in my book a cycle off four different pitchers by Andre Thornton against the Red Sox. That's unheard of. Nobody gets a cycle off four different pitchers. Well, Andre Thornton did. I got Archie Gianfranco getting hit by pitch. He's a switch hitter from both sides of the plate in the same game. I mean, stuff like that matter to people who love baseball. If you don't care, you don't care. I understand that. Well, I have my books, and I love my scorebooks. If I do happen to go, and it may have been no more than three occasions in the last 37 years that I went to a game in which I didn't have my book, and I found myself at a game, and I did then kept score on the available scorecard, and then copied it down into my scorebook. So I have every game I have ever been to at any level, including college. I got a college game. 1984, I'm covering the NBA Finals, the Western Conference, Phoenix and L.A., and I'm in Phoenix. And guess what? Arizona State is hosting North Carolina in a baseball game. And in that game that I kept score are eight future major leaguers, including Barry Bonds and Odomi McDowell and Walt Weiss and B.J. Surhoff, and two future major league managers, Walt Weiss and Don Wakamatsu. Now, to anybody who loves baseball, that is a treasured item. That's like having a piece of art from that fell out of Monet's portfolio, and nobody knew, and you got it. Now, I'm not being facetious. To a baseball fan, it's the same thing. So that's why I keep score.
Mm. We have not touched on two other sports, and we need to at least touch on them briefly. One of them is the game of hockey, and of the four big sports here in America. You say hockey is by far the hardest of the four big mainstream team sports to write about. And I think you're not just saying about you, but that's very true for you in that you don't know the game of hockey the way you know these other games. But even in general, why is hockey so hard to write about?
Well, a 2-1 hockey game, and once you get done describing the three goals, you better know something else about the game to fill in the rest of the story, wouldn't you think? If hockey were 10-8, you would count all the goals, and then you'd have your story written. You have to know the nuances of the game to write it well. You really have to understand the play before the play before the play before the play that set up the goal. You have to understand the responsibilities of the different positions to know when somebody's made a terrific play the average fan would never know. I don't have that knowledge. I learned hockey as I've learned it from the outside in, as I say. I've never skated. I've never played hockey. I've skated, and I've held a hockey stick in my hand. I've never done two of them at the same time. Played basketball, played baseball, played, no football, as any American knows football growing up. I told you I managed the team. We all understand football and baseball and basketball. But, boy, does it take a very special inside knowledge to understand hockey. There are so many nuances that are unavailable to the average writer or fan. And I admire anybody who can write hockey well. I've worked with people who could do it. We've got two of them in our employ right now. Fluto Shinzawa is amazing to me what this young man does writing hockey. Kevin Paul DuPont knows his hockey. We have a fine hockey writer now, Emily Benjamin, and I admire anybody who can write hockey. It is not easy. It is very, very difficult.
Hmm. I think a lot of readers will be a little bit shocked when they read the first sentence of chapter 22 of your book. You write these words: "If they stopped playing football in the next 5 minutes, it wouldn't bother me at all." In other words, if the game of football winked out of existence, you wouldn't be bothered. And we don't have to read much further before we get the gist of what you're saying. What troubles you so much about the game of football?
It's a brutal, barbaric game in which the final result is carnage and maiming people, and that's that. I mean, that's irrefutable. And the object of the game is to hit and hurt. And you say, what about boxing? Well, Yeah, and look at how far boxing's fallen down in our consciousness. Yeah, football is a brutal, barbaric game, and we've made a compromise, a pact with the devil, a Faustian pact, that we love the competition, and it has so many advantages for fans once a week, events, betting, et cetera, that people love the violence of the hits and all that, fine. The fact is, though, that now we know that in addition to the fact that so many of its participants at the highest level will face later life problems with bum, shoulders, hips, elbows, knees, et cetera, that they now clearly have a chance of cognitive problems. The NFL admits that one of three current players are going to suffer cognitive problems as they get older. And America just yawns. They just yawn at this. We accept the carnage to get the product, to have our Sundays and our Monday nights and our Thursday nights now. And I have a hard time accepting the casual nature and callousness of the people who run it to the physical carnage that they supervise on a game by game basis. Yet all that said, I'm a good American. What do you think I did yesterday? I had people over to watch a football game. I mean, we've made our compromise with this devil, and it's getting harder and harder though to make it. And the concussion thing is really front and center. I have said this for years. The mothers of America could shut football down tomorrow. They could say, he ain't playing. And in 10 years, the supply would be shut off. This isn't going to happen. But they could do it. If they chose, they could shut football down tomorrow. Think about that. And that would be that. And so for me, though I appreciate it, and I can talk, I'll talk football history and talk lots of stuff with anybody that wants to talk it. If we took it, we have a giant smorgasbord table of sports in America. If we took football off the menu, we would have plenty of other sports 12 months a year. They're all overlapped now anyway, that I wouldn't miss it. But as long as it's in front of me and I need to have a professional knowledge of it because I am still quite active doing television and radio, and I write a column 2 or 3 Sundays a month for the Globe. I have to live with the idea that football dominates from August until Super Bowl. I pay attention. But believe me, I wouldn't miss it.
You know, as you describe that, I'm reminded of something from my other life. My full-time job is teaching voice at our local liberal arts college, and one of my finest freshman men was also a really fine football player in high school. And I remember when his audition was done, we were asking this big, strapping young man if he had any interest in still playing football because, as it so happens, that would be a problem where we are because football practice and choir practice are head-to-head and you really can't do both. And he said, oh, no, I'm so sick of what football has done to my body. And this is a young man walking around really perfectly healthy, but it made me wonder if maybe more and more young men are going to begin to say this at an earlier and earlier age, that they do not want to subject their bodies to what happens when you are out on the football field.
Well, I mean, I can relate to that if they do, because the reason I became the football manager is that we had a policy of playing intramural house football, and I didn't want to play because I wanted to play basketball. And I'm not a contact sports devotee, and that's that. And so, but I don't know how far down the road we are with that. The tide is turning certainly slightly. The concussion issue has gotten the nation's attention in a way it didn't 10, 15 years ago. There is no question about that. And they're trying to make it quote unquote safer, and they're trying to eliminate helmet to helmet hits, and they're trying to protect quarterbacks, and we understand all that. And it is a marginally safer game in that regard, but we do have bigger, stronger, swifter people who create harder and contacts. The physics of the game have changed enormously. You know that in 1976, there were no people, look it up, I did, no people in the National Football League who weighed 300 pounds, at least not on the roster, not on the street, not one. That's the height of the Steel Curtain Steelers. That's why I always picked that year. And now, you know, do I have to tell you? I just went to a division. Well, there was no such thing as Division II anymore, but the FCS, right? Is that what it is? I get the FBS and the FCS mixed up. But I went to a game last week, it just so happens, in which the losing team had 9 kids over 300, 4 over 330, and 1 who weighed 345, and the winning team had 5 300 pounders at that level. Forget about the higher level. Well, none of those kids should be weighing 300 pounds. Before we even get into that, you know, none of them should be weighing 300. And this is where football's going. So, good luck to people.
The last really quick question, in addition to all that we've talked about, you have also had the joy of covering a number of different Olympic games. Mm-hmm. And when you first mentioned this at the very beginning of the book, you say you can't imagine your career without covering those 11 Olympic Games, flawed and bloated as they are. The Olympics remain a fascinating laboratory for anyone who loves good sporting competition and just plain people watching.
It was a great, tremendous eye-opening exposure for me to get out in the world and see what the rest of the world's all about, that there were other sports other than baseball, football, basketball, and hockey, what a medal means to a small nation, the intense competition. When I discovered, for example, that the cross-country skiers who are astonishingly fit in the cardiovascular sense are among the most amazing athletes I've ever seen. I was witness to one of the great athletic rivalries of ever history. History was Norway-Italy in a 4x10 cross-country relay in which over 3 successive Olympiads, they were separated by a half a ski length and in over 120 kilometers. That's an amazing rivalry. When I saw a Greco-Roman wrestler named Alexander Karelin, who was one of the most fearsome athletes I've ever seen in my life, and that undefeated for 13 years, and then finally beaten by an American, Rulon Gardner. This had nothing to do with all our conventional sports. It was, and they always came in the middle of a season, the middle of the winter, summer, get away from our sports, get some new perspective, or in the middle of the winter, get away and get a new perspective. There's so much more going on out there, outside of the American narrow parochial mindset that I was exposed to, and I'm grateful I had that exposure.
Hmm. Well, we learn about all kinds of other fascinating figures in your book, including, of course, Larry Bird and Bobby Knight and many, many others, including some really fine and fascinating athletes whom we should know better. But we leave it to our listeners to take your book in hand, Scribe, My Life in Sports, published by Bloomsbury. Bob Ryan, thank you so much for all the good work you've done over all these many years and for writing such a fascinating memoir and for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. I've enjoyed
this.
It's been
my pleasure to converse with you as well. Thank you.
Again, the previously scheduled interview for today with Nan Calvert, Jane Herring, and Sister Jane from the Eco Justice Center has been postponed until a week from today, the 23rd of February. Tomorrow on the morning show, in observance of Black History Month, I'll be rebroadcasting my conversation with the author of a book called Giants, The Parallel Lives of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. We'll also have some favorites from the archives for Monday, which of course is President's Day. And you'll also hear a conversation I recently recorded with a tribute actor who enjoys portraying Abraham Lincoln. On Tuesday next week, I'll be speaking with guitarist and composer David Maldonado, who is the featured guest on the next concert of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And we will be talking with him about his long career and about the tradition of flamenco, which is a very, very important part of his career and legacy, and which will figure prominently on that Kenosha Symphony concert. Next Wednesday, a couple of different interviews, including one with Jonathan Starr, who is going to be featured this weekend on 60 Minutes, telling his story of his courageous and relentless efforts to create a marvelous new school in the war-torn and poverty-stricken nation of Somaliland. And he has written a very, very interesting book about the experience called It Takes a School. And we'll talk to him next Wednesday. I already mentioned next Thursday, the program that was originally scheduled for today with Nan Calvert, Jane Herring, and Sister Jane. And a week from tomorrow, yet another series of interviews in observance of Black History Month. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer